Welcome to the Plateforms podcast part one, where the main findings from a household study conducted in five countries, Norway, Sweden, Ireland, Italy and Germany will be presented. My name is Suse, I am part of the German research team and I will accompany you through this podcast. So within this study, we tried to open up the black box of the household in order to understand the impact of new modes of food provisioning on food practices. More specifically, we wanted to find out what are potentials and barriers for sustainable food practices in relation to digital or alternative modes of food provisioning. In order to generate this understanding around such complex relationships, we used a qualitative method mix consisting of 40 guided interviews in households using these new modes of food provisioning in each country, accompanied by a photo food diary, a kitchen tour, and a digital walkthrough. Sounds interesting, right? So let's jump right into it and let's hear from Marie about one of the findings from the Norwegian team.
What we've been interested in our study is to uncover how these rather new online food provisioning services are integrated or not integrated into the everyday food practices of consumers. And the reason was that we wanted to explore what the barriers and opportunities might be to achieve this sustainability potential that we see in online provisioning services. The food provisioning services in our study, which were box schemes and online grocery stores, do in fact explicitly market this potential in terms of reducing transport emissions, reducing food waste, and increasing the consumption of organic products and vegetarian meals. And what we found is that although both box scheme and online grocery store services can be seen to provide infrastructure and technology that could, at least in theory, influence food practices to become more sustainable, this potential is currently not being unleashed as we see it. And we think that this is partly because the services come into conflict with the already set routines and rhythms of people's everyday lives, on the one hand, and the sometimes unpredictable changes that occur within those routines on the other. And as such, there might be a lack of flexibility that needs to be addressed, as well as making more sustainable choices the default, rather than a conscious knowledge-based choice.
This complexity of household practices is also stressed by the Swedish team, and Christian explains the following.
First one is that they show the complexity of household and sort of teaches us to take this into account. Digital food platforms experience difficulties when attempting to become part of consumers' household practices. Now, these difficulties do not necessarily have to do with the technical properties of the platform, but rather with the complexity of the household practices. So multiple practices are performed in a household, and food consumption, as we know from previous research also, is both shaped by other food practices, but also non-food practices. Practices like picking up the kids from school, driving them to a soccer practice, exercising, different work schedules. So all these sort of different practices that are going on in the household create complexity and difficulties when you're trying to fit in a new digital food provisioning platforms. You have to sort of find space and a way to work within the existing nexus of household practices. Now, in addition to that, you also have multiple household members, usually, which have different preferences in terms of tastes, but also different food ambitions. So some want to be eat more vegetables, others want to focus on sustainability issues, and so on and so forth. And this also creates a complexity which makes it difficult for the digital food platforms to find their way into consumers' everyday life and become sort of routinized.
As well in Germany, we have seen this necessity of working a platform or any new mode of food provisioning into the household. And we would add that this task was mostly performed by women. They were also most likely the ones who initiated a new mode of food provisioning, may it be to shop digitally, through a food assembly, ordering vegetable boxes, or becoming a member of a CSA. Nonetheless, we observed in our cases that these socio-technical innovations very often helped to structure and organize food practices. So the delivery of the vegetable box or the share of the CSA, for example, was the starting point for planning and organizing the rest of the week in terms of food. And interestingly, digital shopping in particular enabled a fairer distribution of the workload in terms of food in many households. For example, we were often told that families or couples would sit together in front of the technical device and did the shopping and planning together. And thus, this task does not have to be done by just one person. The difference in organization and planning of shopping was one of the interesting findings as well from the Irish team.
There were some very interesting findings with our mainstream shoppers who purchase groceries online. Generally, our mainstream shoppers could be classed as organized or disorganized, with organized shoppers being highly structured and routinized, engaging in shopping lists, meal planning, stock checking, budget control, etc. On the other hand, disorganized shoppers didn't meal plan or write shopping lists, but rather shopped frequently to satisfy their needs and their moods, and was heavily influenced by special offers and did engage in impulse buying, which had consequences for sustainability in terms of over-provisioning of food and in terms of food waste. However, what was interesting here were the online shoppers. So the online environment presented a hybrid of an organized and disorganized shopper. The sliding door of online shopping is such that really the list is already there waiting for the shopper to alter to their needs week by week. And shopping lists for online shoppers were usually composed in real time from previous orders or their usuals lists rather than pre-planned. So they still did not have a shopping list before they logged on. So the outcome in terms of the final list is that it is organized and it comprises of all the necessities to feed the family for the week, with full dishes and meal requirements being a priority. But effort on the part of the shopper was very minimal. So for online shoppers, meal planning was not pre-planned, as witnessed with organized in-store shoppers, but rather the online platform and the nature of the basket at the end before checkout enabled shoppers to meal plan in real time and then return to shopping if they needed to add anything extra to make a meal. So they could observe their basket at the end in order to do this. And many of the online shoppers began shopping this way due to either family demands or due to their disorganized nature of their food shopping previously in store. So online shoppers tended to prioritize adequate stock assortment for their meals, but healthy eating aspirations meant that sometimes there was an over-provisioning of fruit and vegetables in particular, repeatedly, which is really due to them relying on the same list every week. But this fruit and veg or these healthy eating aspirations ended that all this perishable food may not be used in the week and would end up as waste before the next order is placed the following week. However, overall, in the case of online shoppers, the material infrastructure of the app reorganizes the shopping practice to one that's more structured and presents less opportunity to impulse buy and have less food waste overall. So the online shop facilitates the shopper to continue to be unprepared but achieve a balanced food shop. So the material infrastructure of the app essentially puts structure around their otherwise unpreparedness really for food shopping.
Since Claire raised the issue of waste, I would like to share another observation from Germany in relation to this. Looking at alternative modes of food provisioning, which in some cases were digitally supported, like food assembly, and in others, they weren't, like buying vegetables through a CSA, we observed that purchasing food digitally helped to prevent food waste. In both cases, consumers from the CSA and consumers from a food assembly were highly motivated to use up all the food, but the former group more often reported that they eventually would have to throw things away since they received just too much in general, for example during harvest season, or too much of a specific vegetable like kale during winter, and they just didn't know what to do with it. On the other hand, consumers from Food Assembly reported that they were able to order exactly what they needed from home digitally with an eye on the fridge and the pantry, so they hardly ever had too much food and had to throw it away. And taking these various international observations together, it seems that digitalization offers some potential for sustainable food provisioning. Nonetheless, these digital channels of food provisioning also have to be adapted into the household practices. The Swedish team calls this a form of digital labor, and Christian describes this finding more detailed.
Another main finding is that digitalization of food often requires a lot of consumer work. So our results illustrate the consumer work involved in something that is often characterized as the effortless digitalization of household practices. Digital food platforms have to be worked into household. And in order for this to be accomplished, these devices need to be reconfigured by consumers. So considerable work on the part of consumer is thus needed in order for digital food platforms to become integrated into everyday life. Now, this is a form of digital labor, some would say, that is often overlooked. Consumers have to learn to use the platforms, they have to coordinate multiple practices, and they have to carry out different sort of laborious tasks in order to get the digital food platforms to work in their everyday life. Now, this is important to take into account because it means that when trying to promote different digital food platforms, we need to acknowledge that it's not a completely sort of seamless process, but it requires a lot from consumers. So we're asking a lot of them in order for digitalization to work.
Another critical issue in relation to digitalization and food practices was raised by the Italian team. Following, Alice talks about one of their related findings.
The use of food apps, so novel forms of food sharing and commercialization, does help people to approach alternative sustainable markets. Because involvement is little, change in overall everyday practices is somehow limited. Whereas in the case of grassroots provisioning, which requires more involvement in terms of time and socialization, changes are more profound. Yet these kind of provisioning channels are somehow less appealing to the masses of people.
Alicia's last comment, that more sustainable provisioning channels appear to be less appealing to the masses, relates to an observation made by the Norwegian team. Let's hear what Marie reports about their interviewees.
And actually, none of the informants in our study used box schemes or online grocery stores as a means to make pro-environmental choices. They weren't really paying much attention to the marketing of sustainability made by the services, because their main concern was convenience. And so convenience, saving time and money, and reducing the mental load of organizing meals are the primary motivations of the informants in our study. And of course, this is known by the services, and they are also marketing time saving and efficiency as major benefits of using their service. So in conclusion, this made us think that there might be a potential to offer more sustainable alternatives within the frame of convenience, of time saving, thrift and efficiency, rather than sustainability, and sort of focusing on convenience as the main selling point and then making sustainability choices the default.
Interestingly, this description of the participants from Norway contrasts with the description of the participants from Italy. which is as follows.
Normally, we think of consumers as self-interested and selfish subjects who want to minimize cost and maximize the ease of provisioning, cooking, and maybe also the quantity of food. But we found that this is not always the case. People who can afford this and also have the time and cultural capital to engage in alternative forms of food consumption do look for quality and ethics in food far more than, for example, price squeeze. And they are also ready to learn and experiment with novel food and food practices.
Another observation in relation to household concerns towards sustainability was made by the Irish team.
Our overall observations are that all participants have an awareness of sustainability, but they differ, particularly across the groups, in terms of the level to which they prioritise sustainability in their food consumption. It was evident across all groups that food offers enjoyment and pleasure and is linked to nourishment, health, family and socialising. But for our most sustainability conscious group, which were from a CSA, social connections created through food were central to the role that food played in their lives. According to this group, food is eating together, cooking together, food is life, it is social, it means life. So the pleasure and enjoyment derived from food was central to their commitment to the range of activities they engaged in around their food consumption. This extended beyond the enjoyment of eating to the joy of sharing recipes and socialising in particular. Consequently, the time invested in creating meals and preserving local seasonal food was seen as part of the overall experience, and there were no tensions around food and sustainability for this group. Food was expressed with a sense of pride and fulfilment, and it was part of their significant lifestyle change towards sustainability. While social aspects were important to mainstream shoppers, health, nutrition and enjoyment of eating seemed more to the forefront of their thoughts. For this group, food helped them express elements of their identity, or in particular to serve a functional purpose. As they described, food is about nutrition, I like to be health conscious, it's survival, without it we die. So really for this group, food was more about survival than about living. And while being a source of enjoyment too, there were some tensions around food and sustainability as they sought solutions really to satisfy household demands, such as healthy food for children. This sometimes resulted in a trade-off between health and sustainability. Food here was purchased for health reasons, but maybe wasted when healthy eating aspirations weren't met during the week. But irrespective of the core meanings ascribed to foods across the cohorts, it is evident that characteristics such as local, seasonal, artisan and organic did hold an elevated status and offered pleasure, health, social and environmental benefits for consumers.
Last but not least, Christian will also share an observation made by the Swedish team in relation to households' food practices and sustainability.
Another main finding, we would say, is the sort of acknowledgement and the realization that there are multiple forms of sustainability at play. So our results suggest that efforts to promote sustainable household consumption need to acknowledge that multiple enactments of sustainability are possible. That is, in trying to promote one version of sustainability, it is imperative to also be sensitive and responsive to households' multiple and also potentially conflicting enactments of sustainability. Some consumers might focus on local food, others look at the ecological food products. Another type of household might avoid certain ingredients, which they find problematic. Others are focused on reducing food waste. And not only can these different sustainability goals be conflicting, but they also commonly shift, is what our studies clearly show, that households move from one concern to another. And as they do, also their household food practices change.
Since Christian already started within his last contribution, we would like to conclude this podcast with a few more general observations as well as recommendations derived from the various international studies. Emma and Christian from the Swedish team will start.
So when it comes to the question, then what are your overall observations from the interviews? Well, when you start a research project, there are some things that might surprise you. And in this case, the interviews, they have shown that change is much more common than we anticipated from the beginning of the project. So the participants in the interviews, they would talk about change in a number of different ways. So they would talk about change in terms of the service provider they were using. So they would talk about switching from company to company when it came to these meal boxes. And they would also talk about change when it came to changing the different options they would go with. So for one time, they might go with the vegetarian option, but then they would switch to the Weight Watchers option, so go back to the more everyday option. And then there's also another finding or another observation that we did during the interviews is that most of the participants, they use multiple platforms. They talk about using meal boxes, but they would also at the same time be using different apps for buying food, or they would be using digital local food nodes. And lastly, then another takeaway from the interviews is that it is the complexities of households, that bringing new ways of food consumption into the households is not an easy thing. So first, it needs to be configured, or it needs to fit with other ways that these households consume food. And second, it also needs to fit with other activities in everyday life, such as picking up kids from school or going to soccer practice, for example.
Now, finally, our analysis also points to the need to base efforts to promote sustainable food alternatives on a contextualized understanding of household food consumption. So armchair studies of household or surveys, which is sort of the normal way of studying food consumption, are not enough to understand this contextualized understanding. We need to look at actual practices, and we need also to engage with households. It is only by doing that we can understand, for example, the complexity of household practices, or that we can realize that there are multiple ways of doing sustainable food consumption in play here, or that can we sort of appreciate the amount of work needed in everyday digitalization. So a contextualized understanding of household consumption is key in order to be able to promote sustainable food consumption in a more realistic way and in a more effective way. And key in achieving this are qualitative and ethnographically inspired studies of household interviews, but also observing practices of household.
Next, we hear from Marie from the Norwegian team with recommendations for businesses and policymakers who want to work on unleashing the sustainability potential.
So our first recommendation is to engage consumers in co-designing the services so that they become more aligned with their needs. We often see that the intended use of a digital technology does not necessarily correlate with how it is used by consumers at home, who are in many cases circumventing the intended way of use to adjust the technology and more to their own needs and wishes. And the second recommendation is, as I already mentioned, to focus on convenience, because sustainability may not be a concern for the users of the services. And thirdly, we recommend to become more aware of the context in which the service operates, to see how the service fits into the routines and disruptions of everyday life, and make it flexible enough to accommodate people's needs within their context. And finally, in terms of scaling up, we think that online grocery shopping might hold the greatest potential, at least in the short run, because this mode of food purchasing is quite similar to the shopping people do in physical stores. And requires fewer adjustments, you could say, to existing practices than meal box schemes and alternative food networks, for instance, might do. So, but in the long run, these more alternative modes of purchasing food might become more significant contributors to a more sustainable food future.
As from the German team, a general observation we were able to make is that interviewees very often reported about their individual struggles in terms of decisions and practices related to food and sustainability. What is the right thing to buy in terms of sustainability? Should or could I be doing more in terms of my food practices? So one recommendation we draw from this observation is the need to break down the complexity around sustainability into tangible parts for consumers. This could mean, for example, developing a sustainability rating or label that can be found on every food product, and perhaps even assessing different categories such as CO2 emission, water and material consumption, or production conditions. And in terms of the different food provisioning channels, we want to introduce the idea of a digital search engine that provides customized informations. So via a search mask, consumers can select different needs and desires, such as regionality, packaged or convenience, and the corresponding options of food provisioning channels or platforms will be displayed. Last but not least, Alice gives us some general observations and recommendations derived from the Italian study.
So although many people look for local organic quality food, often organic and ethical, what we call good food, producing a fruitful encounters between producers and consumers, is not always easy. And this is due to the time and space organization of everyday life in the city, where these foods are not easily available and mass distribution often looks as the best and easiest option. Nevertheless, the spread of food hubs that are close to where people live and offer good food at affordable prices seems to increase the adoption of sustainable food purchase and also sustainable food practices at home, for example, reducing food waste, producing less consumption of animal products, etc. And albeit this does not satisfy the overall food demands of households, and indeed this is far from doing that, food hubs are a good way into alternative sustainable food habits.
That brings us to the end of our first part of the Platforms podcast, and I hope you have enjoyed this insight into some of the results from our household study. If you're interested in some tales from the fields, then stay tuned for our second part.